Welcome to the Pop Cult Podcast. Here are your hosts, Ariana and Seth.
This is the Pop Cult Podcast. I'm Seth.
I'm Ariana.
And I want to apologize in advance. I've been struggling with some allergies lately. So if my voice sounds a little off, I sniffle or cough during this episode, and that's the reason why. So I am one of those people that's very sensitive to those noises. So I just wanted to warn you all in advance. I'll try to do my sniffling and coughing off of the mic, such as right now. There you go. So we will be reviewing two A24 movies, recent releases. A little later, we're going to be talking about Alex Garland's Civil War. But first up, we want to talk about Problemista, the debut feature film from writer-director Julio Torres. Alejandro is an aspiring toy designer who's struggling to bring his unusual ideas to life in New York City. As time on his work visa runs out, a job assisting an art world outcast becomes his only hope to stay in the country and realize his dream. Ariana, this was not your first encounter with Julio Torres's work.
We make it sound like I personally encountered it several times. But yeah, don't look at me like that.
This is an audio podcast. I don't know what you mean by look at you like that. This doesn't make any sense. Anyway, this is not the first time you have encountered Julio Torres's work.
No.
We are familiar with him, I think, first from Los Espookies.
Yes.
Though we had been aware of his work on SNL without knowing it was him. I think most famously, he's the writer of the Ryan Gosling Papyrus sketch.
Yes.
Our favorite is the Wells for Sensitive Boys sketch, I think. I'm going to speak for you in saying that I think that's our favorite.
Yes,
of his.
It is.
And we also have seen his stand-up special, as well as a few of his stand-up spots on late-night shows. Mm-hmm. So before we talk about Problemista in specific, what do you think of Julio Torres as a comedian, as a storyteller, as an artist?
I think he is amongst like the, it's sort of like the new wave of comedy where it is a mix of performance art and comedy.
Very Dimitri Martin.
Yes. And for example, I love one of his jokes just being like, this is blonde era me. Brunette me does not give a fuck. Like, brunette me gave a fuck. Blonde me does not give a fuck, which is a thing that I've seen a lot amongst, like, people of the gay community. I think that's also one of the interesting things about his work. Even though he is openly gay, it's not hypersexual. It's just there. So, like, we don't really have a moment of him deeply talking about his gay experiences, but there are it's sprinkled there enough that you understand that he is not a hetero cis man.
Well, it's
by
it's,
any means.
It's one of those where he has attractions to men in his work, but yeah, it's like in the way that any average person engages with their sexuality on a day-to-day basis as they're dealing with all the other headaches of existing in the world, right?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that person's attractive, I gotta get to work now because like, that's what I'm gonna do.
I think it's sort of like he's that generation that sort of like, instead of like really diving into the culture, it's like how we would say like almost decadent, because we were talking about a few days ago how early 2000s felt very decadent.
Yeah.
When it's also the beginning of the recession.
It was like a trashy decadence in the early
2000s. It's the knowledge that things were going to get fucked up. Well, let's go, you know, fuck it up even further. Because I remember like one of my first like checks to like go into the economy was in the early 2000s. That I got sent by Bush when it was like one of the.
Oh, yeah. He sent it like $300.
Yes.
It was a weird move.
That wasn't really like.
Because like $300 even then, like, I don't know, like pays a bill.
Yeah, but they're like, go spend it. And you're like, okay. And I think it's just like, if, like, there is this almost like we grew up with this decadence only to come to a term that people expect us to continue, but they're kind of like, hold up a second. We're worried about debt. We're worried about climate change. We're worried that maybe the dreams that we have for ourselves aren't realistic or even good for everybody at the end of the day, even though mental health wise, it probably would be better if we are reaching out for something that is meaningful for us.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of the dreams that people have been conditioned to have are not meaningful. And I think that's in Torres in this film. It's about a character who's trying to find connections with other people. And I do enjoy the weirdo connection that he ends up with by the end of this movie. And we'll talk a little later about some of the reactions I've seen to how the movie ends and why I think a lot of people don't understand Torres's perspective. So let's get into the movie a little more. It's essentially Torres's take on, I'm going to guess, his specific immigrant experience. I know he is the son of, he's from El Salvador, and his father was a civil engineer. I think his mother was a fashion designer. So it doesn't necessarily sound like a poor background,
Oh,
right?
I think he was
Middle
like middle
class, kind of,
class.
yeah. Or middle class in quote marks. Basically, poor people who've been given a few crumbs into thinking they're not poor. And so the experience he has, I do kind of wonder how much was his own experience or also gathered from other people he met along the way. And I'm sure it's a mix, right? It's also a very millennial perspective in the way he discusses labor, in the way he discusses the costs of living. His living arrangements are very millennial. There's something that boomers don't have a lot of. Like, he shares an apartment with at least two other people. And then by the end of the movie, it's four. And that's an experience in the way he's living at age, because in real life he's 37 years old. So this character is maybe a few years younger than that.
Yeah, I think it's also like a mix of not just millennials, but probably Gen Z is probably confronting this right now. I deeply love this film, and I was deeply touched by this film in multiple assets of it. I like when I think about in comparison to what later is going to be venomous like feelings towards the movie when it comes to Civil
I
War.
don't know if it's
This
a venomous
I
amount.
don't know, but it's like I don't feel as much as I feel towards this film. Like there was just not just like enchanting because I thought at first it was going to be super whimsical, but in fact, there are times that it's really toned in reality, but it's just very edited very well. Almost a playful French, what's that director's like? I forgot, Tati, like,
Jacques Tati?
yeah, like
I
there's
can see that,
certain
yeah.
shots that, like, for example, he's going up the escalators and it's like boom, and they're simple shots. But they're done very well about trying to be playful without being like, we're not going to go into the whimsical stuff. Well, that's later.
He's the clever fool in a confusing world, which is essentially Tati's character in his movies. Yeah. I saw someone say this was the Devil Wears Prada in the COVID era. And I thought, like, that's a pretty good explanation. Because Tilda Swinton's character is an intense person. But if you look at Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, she's someone who's very much in control. Elizabeth, Tilda Swinton's character, is an intense person who has no control, which just makes her worse as things go on. We'll talk about the amount of emotional identification I could see happening by Ariana while we watch this movie. There were certain scenes where there was a scene where we had to pause the movie because Ariana was laughing so hard.
Stop, and it made it worse when you were like, are you feeling something? And it just cranked it up because it was almost like a release valve.
Yeah. Julio Torres feels there's elements of him that do feel kind of like a millennial Paul Rubens. And there's like, you were talking about the whimsy of the movie. I was expecting it to be a little more cartoonish than it was. And I've seen some people say they were disappointed that it wasn't. I don't know. Feel like I'm sort of ambivalent on that because, as is, I think it works. But I do wonder if he had leaned into more of the, like, how Loss of Spookies is bizarre. It's a weirdo world. This is not that strange of a world. It's more, the strangeness is happening in his subconscious, which the movie will cut into the way he's playing events out in his head. Now, why did you identify so strongly with this character?
Oh God. So the title Problemista, you can like, oh, why a problemista? He is essentially someone that, with or without meaning to, is causing problems for himself, right? Because of the path that he opts to go to. I love that the fact that there's this whole narration explaining that his mother made him a world where he did not want like for anything, so therefore he asked for everything.
Well, it feels like it's kind of based on his real mother now
Yes.
that we know her background,
And
right?
so it's there are these dual arcs that even though his mother's arc doesn't get a lot, it is this understanding that she has a son who is not going to ask her for much help because even the little that she can offer isn't going to help him at all. It is her having to deal with the fact that her ultimate creation, aka her son, is now out of her hands and she can no longer mold it or push it to a certain direction. And then I identified, even though like I'm Puerto Rican and like my passport can never be a Puerto Rican passport, it has to be an American passport because, you know, colonialism. It's the immigration process of immigrating here to the Netherlands, and then him talking about that
And
process,
the way it's
and
visualized.
it's the way it's visualized, and then later on the arguments that he has with Elizabeth and the arguments that he has in his heads, and
Well,
like
and like the fact that she can't really understand what he's going through in the immigration process, I would think that probably reminds you of a few conversations you've had with Dutch people.
with Dutch people, and it's also just sort of like in the past having, even with like current work environments of when he meets Elizabeth, there is something so magnetic to him about her, even though he's kind of like, this is a problem.
Her chaotic tendency is fascinating to
It's
him.
fascinating to him because it's something that's missing within him, right?
He's a very controlled, muted person.
And so he follows her, and oh, and I can tell you with full heartedness, there are times that I've been attracted, and this is not like, you know, romantic or physical. You're just attracted to someone else's chaos because you yourself think, I can never defend myself the way that person defended themselves. I can never dominate the room or a conversation the way this person dominates the room and conversation. So you latch onto them and you guys become like a yin and yang situation until it becomes so toxic that you can't really survive in that environment because you're being pushed down because they're so good at the argument, right? They thrive on the argument, and it's something that you kind of like, you know, it's gonna hit you soon. And I think it's like he puts himself in a position where it's sort of like, of course you're gonna get, of course that's gonna happen to you, dumb dumb. That's the reason you liked
Well, the
her.
film is essentially Ali watching Elizabeth treat other people the way she will inevitably treat him.
Yes.
And it's one of those where anybody that's ever encountered someone like that is sitting there knowing, like, in the third act of this movie, she's suddenly going to turn to him and start speaking the same
Yeah,
way.
like
And she does. Like, that's, yeah.
she is like, Tilda Swinton, of course, she's a fucking gem in
Oh, she's
Eureka.
wonderful. Yeah.
But it's the tiny details, like the light being on
Yeah, I know somebody said greatest performance by a smartphone flashlight.
her, which is something you tell me, have you ever had like these really intense, like either co-work or something like that, that after you watched them do something like incredibly horrendous and you still have to walk away with these people, they have the audacity to be like, and I don't know why you're walking around with a crazy person. And that is your cue to tell them that they're not crazy.
I would say, as an autistic person who's worked primarily in elementary school environments, I have not, I never bonded or made friends with anybody I worked with, so I never had that experience.
I've had that experience like maybe once or twice, and watching it on screen really hit
Oh, I
me.
could tell. It was very clear to me. This was a film you felt in your bones.
is a conversation when you watch someone go fucking buck wild on someone on a public, like a certain, like either a waiter
I feel like I've
or
never even been around
person.
someone like that. I've just, I think there's some weird autism power where I just like avoid, like if I get the sense, like the hair on the back of my neck stands up, I'm like, I'm leaving this space. I don't like, I don't like
because
vibes
like
here.
it kind of reminds me, I will not name this boss.
I know who it is.
Yeah. One time we were at
Does it rhyme with man
no,
hell?
like she listens to this podcast.
You don't know. She's crying right now in her
in a graphic design setting, and like she like this person was like updating the website. She is eating while pointing onto their screen, and that person is multiple times telling her, "Can you please stop pointing on my screen?"
And it's like that person is not even saying anything.
She like did not register the amount of times that she would be on the phone and she would also be eating, and then the person was like, "Can you, ma'am, can you please stop eating on the phone?" And she just keeps shoving like sunflower seeds in her mouth.
I think these are people that are like in a rush to die. That's good. They're like, they just want to get through life so they can be done with it. That's what, that's the vibe I get. Is they're just like, this is overwhelming me. Can we just do this as quickly as possible so I can die?
That's the worst part. I think having worked with people like them, it's as if the world owes them something. They have been the odd person out most of their life.
Chip on their shoulder.
A chip on their shoulder, and unable to realize that softness or being agreeable could help, even though there are things that are like Elizabeth is right about how like she tries to tell Ale like you have to become a problem for other people in order to get what you want out of life, and that part sometimes is true, but it's this thing of it, watching it happen like on a day-to-day basis, you know, someone put cream in your coffee when you didn't want to have cream. That's not the moment to blow up on them.
But that's when they blow up.
Yeah, that's when they blow up.
I would say that I think what this film is about is the benefits of having high emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Because it is a film about a character, Alejandro, who has an incredibly high level of emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
He never breaks down, even though his situation is far more dire than anything Elizabeth is going through. Her emotional response is disproportionate in comparison.
Yeah, and she's also just so unaware when she is able to do him a favor on how she did it. She didn't do it properly, which I feel that within my bones when I've worked with people like that, because they'll be like, oh, I just signed a I said yes. If I'm saying yes through text, or if you have me recorded saying yes, that's fine, right? And you're like, no, there's...
In a court of law, I can't use this text. I also like the fact that unlike The Devil Wears Prada, and I can't really remember how that movie concluded because it was a boring-ass movie. But like the Meryl Streep's character is still seen as bad at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
That's the opposite in this movie, where I feel this movie, Elizabeth is not a villain. She's just a character who is in a confused state of being, who's overwhelmed by the world around her. And that's something that Ale can see in her that no one else really seems to be able to see other than her husband.
Yeah, and who, like...
And I want to talk about the paintings. Because I know what the paintings mean. It makes sense.
What?
So in the movie, Elizabeth's husband, Bobby, has been cryogenically frozen. And part of that process is archiving all of his paintings. And he created a bunch of paintings of eggs, unhatched eggs. And no one in the modern art world in New York really thought much of them. And she's trying to put together a show of his work because she does need to sell something to raise money to keep him in this cryogenic facility. So the eggs represent potential. You don't know what's in an egg until it hatches. But until it hatches, there is the potential of something.
Yeah.
She is the egg in his paintings.
Yeah.
He sees something in her. And that's what Ale comes to understand, is he also sees that she is the egg. He is also an egg, too. That's why he's able to see it. And he's only able to see it because of his high emotional intelligence.
Yeah, and it's like this, it's this thing of when you meet people like Elizabeth, there is something endearing about them. There's something that's passionate about them. There's something that you wish you were kind of more like them without being 100% like them. There is this tenacity. There is like they've established themselves. They have made enemies. And it's like they make for these wild stories, right? But versus like, The Devil Wears Prada, she at times has like Elizabeth is more endearing and then sometimes like gives this advice that it's so vital and important that you can't let go
Like,
of.
she does understand part of life and some of the things you have to do. And I think the reason she wants to save the paintings is they're portraits of her. And the reason she wants to put on a show is she needs to be seen,
And I
which
think
explains her behavior. And Bobby was the only person that ever saw her until she met Alejandro.
And the problem is, Bobby, from what the scenes that we have, isn't that great of a person
Well, he cheats on
either.
her
He cheats on
constantly.
her. He calls her a Hydra, but then calls her a Hydra to like her face, my beautiful Hydra. And it is also this thing is like, unfortunately, like what you can take from it is Elizabeth has never been able to love somebody without having to hurt them in the process, severely hurt them, like
Or
intentionally
be
hurt them,
hurt too.
or be hurt too. And then there's like a moment where, God, I really love the way that they portrayed like their heightened arguments, which I'm not gonna like display how they
Inside
showed.
his head?
Yes, I
Yeah.
love the way, and I know that most people is like, oh, I wanted to be more like that. No, it
He
wouldn't have been that
balanced
it.
it was he balanced it well by making the fantasy element a subconscious imaginative element.
Yes, and I respect the film because of that. It's when they just get to the point where they're like, they're arguing back and forth. She's bringing up stuff that has nothing to do with the argument. That even Ali's like, why? Why are you bringing this up? You just want to win the argument. And they both just go like, okay, no matter what, we still have a lot of fucking work to do, so let's do it.
Yeah. It's getting past the petty argument to get to the root of what it is we need to get done. And in a way, the film is presenting a little bit of communist ideology there, because under communism, one of the big things that they push, and I think this is true in anarchism and all of the sort of left-wing things, is the end of petty grievance. We have to get to a point where just because someone pisses me off doesn't mean I undermine and sabotage something for the greater good because my ego was bruised. And that is a hard thing to do in a very individualist society. And this movie is sort of about how Alejandro shows Elizabeth, you just need to give up the petty shit. Like, it's not getting you anywhere. That doesn't mean you give up your ferocity. You just learn to use your ferocity to push for the things that matter. And that's the ultimate message of the movie. One of my favorite scenes in the movie, which has nothing to do with any of this, and I'm not going to say how it ends, but just was River Ramirez as the Bank of America representative. And
Blah,
as someone who
blah.
hates Bank of America with a passion, that was a cathartic scene. And the fact that they said Bank of America, I thought they would just not mention the name of the bank, but they did. That was really good. It's a movie that feels very influenced by Pedro Almodovar in the sort of the color scheme, a very bold cartoon colored world, but very like melodramatic, but not over the top, like light melodrama. Did you have more experience with the genre than I? Did you feel any influence of telenovela?
No, not really. I
Yeah.
felt like he really was doing a beautiful balance. I can understand, like, again, it's weird to me that people are like, I want it more cartoonish. I was like, this was perfect for me. This was perfect because this wasn't Los Espookys. Los Espookys had more like
It was more of a Scooby-Doo kind of thing.
telenovela, like Scooby-Doo kind of thing. If you wanted to, that, go back to the
Yeah.
Los Espookys. This
It
was
wasn't just a recreation of a stand-up act.
no, like there were parts of stuff that you're like, ooh, that would have, I could have seen that in the stand-up
The
act.
toy inventor part of it, that was the stand-up act, but he didn't like That wasn't the whole movie.
No, and I love like the touches of it being like children should feel stress or they should be
Or no,
aware.
children should understand like the complexity of life.
Yes. And I love that aspect of it of just being like that part was like the funny whimsical part that I'm sure if you only like highlighted that part, I'm sure Mattel or whoever is kind of like Julio Torres is going to direct the Cabbage Patch Kids.
I would watch a Julio. I mean, I hate this whole like brand movie thing, but if you said Julio Torres's next movie is the Cabbage Patch Kids movie, I'm in. I'm in. Now, will it turn out good? Probably not, but I'd
No.
be interested to see what he does. I also think there were some visual elements that reminded me of Inarritu, kind of like
Yeah.
Birdman, especially when they're on the street and kind of the handheld camera movements and things like
Yeah.
that. It is. Some of the complaints I saw were about how Alejandro never reams out Elizabeth. I saw this on Letterboxd, and people were just confounded and upset that he never tells Elizabeth off and she never gets better and she's such a bad person. And it infuriated them. And to me, I thought, well, I don't think you understood the point of the movie then. If that's how you feel at the end of the movie, were you paying attention? Because the
No.
whole point of the movie is that Alejandro understands her in a way that other people don't, including you. You don't understand her
Yeah.
either. And she's not just because she's like an abrasive person doesn't mean she doesn't have value as a person. And that's this thing in American society of the minute someone becomes an inconvenience or an annoyance to me, whether it's accidental or purposeful, then they lose all value as a human being in others' eyes. And that's a very dangerous path for a society to go down.
I think it's also like this strange thing that like the reason that Alejandro doesn't ream her out in that way is that this is a working relationship. This is a work relationship. This is not the same as if I were to ream out you or a family member for treating me the way that Elizabeth treats Alejandro. It is with this expectation that like you might calm down, turn around and apologize. He can very much see that that's not gonna fucking
Well,
work.
I think it's even more than that because the end of the movie, without giving away any spoilers, there's no reason for him to seek her out at that point. Yet he still does. And I saw people going like, that was so unrealistic to me. I wouldn't believe he would actually do that. And I'm like, no, he would, because yet again, he appreciates the amount of love she has for her husband, who in turn didn't show her appreciation. So Alejandro is able to see the complexity of this woman's life. And it's not just a transactional work thing. Like if it was that, we wouldn't have that ending scene. But
Yeah.
that ending scene implies that this was more than just a job to him. This was something that we don't know. Maybe he found something in her personality that he carried into his own life. And we
Yeah.
kind of see that a little bit at the end
Yeah. And
when
I
he
think,
goes to the toy company at the
yeah.
end,
And I
right?
think it has to do with the ending that they showed was look what you created. Look what you helped create to a certain degree.
He's also the egg.
Yeah.
She got to see the egg hatch. So I'm very interested to know what Torres does next. I hope he's not in any rush to do any sort of follow-up movie because sometimes when comedians do that, the next thing is you can tell that it was made in a rush to try to capitalize on this sort of the fan base you accrued from the first movie. And so I'm just interested to know, in his next project, is he going to go more surreal? Is he going to stay in this space? Is he going to go even more grounded? He has assembled a lot of actors in this movie. From we've mentioned Tilda Swinton, Greta Lee has a small part. RZA plays Elizabeth's husband, Bobby. There's a lot of comedians that are recognizable. Meg Stalter has a small role that's like
Yeah.
perfect for her. I loved Catalina Saavedra as his mother, who
Yes.
was the maid in Rotting in the Sun, which was such a great comedy. And it's another where, man, I wish she had been in more of the movie because she was so good in Rotting in the Sun. But I understood this was more probably he probably loves her as an actress and wanted to find some spot for her. And
Yeah.
based on her schedule, that worked, that kind of
Yeah.
role. But yeah, I am interested to know what. Oh, and then of course, Isabella Rossellini is the narrator of the whole movie, which we never even mentioned. And so it is. It was that perfect balance of sort of whimsical and grounded. And it just has me very interested to see what Torres has next. In a dystopian future America, a team of military-embedded journalists races against time to reach Washington, D.C. before rebel factions descend upon the White House. This is Alex Garland's Civil War. Now, we have watched, I want to say, every film that Alex Garland has at least directed. I would need to look at his screenwriting credits to know if I've seen all of those. Speaking of screenwriting, the film that I can remember bringing his name to my attention first was Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later, which he wrote the script for. Since then, he has written and directed Ex Machina, Annihilation, the television series Devs, and then the film Men. And I would say for me, my consistent feeling with most of these, I would say 28 Days Later, I pulled me in, but that was 2003. I don't know if I would still feel the same way watching it now. That might be a thing to go back and do all the 28, because I think they're going to do 28 months later or something, which I think Garland might be making. I don't know. Is that Garland is a very technically proficient director. His visuals always look flawless. His use of special effects and cinematography is always perfect. But I feel such emotional distance from the characters. And I can tell by the way the film is unfolding, I'm not supposed to feel that. I can tell that he thinks I'm emotionally invested in what happens to these people. And I can't understand where the disconnect is coming between the director and me as an audience member, because I don't know how I'm supposed to feel anything about characters in which you don't really develop them about more than just like surface level. And if you think about Ex Machina, Annihilation, Devs, Men, all these movies, do we really get to know the characters beyond maybe a singular event that kind of, for Men, for example, the protagonist is the death of her partner. That's it. That's all I know about her. For Ex Machina, it's I guess we would talk about the computer developer, Donald, or what's his name?
Glenn Donahoe, I don't know.
Domhnall Gleeson. His character, I guess he's kind of a lonely nerd. I mean, that's like, I don't know why I'm supposed to care about him and what happens to him in this movie. And I feel like Devs especially was probably one of the most egregious ones. For some reason, he really loves this actress, Sonoya Mizuno, who he's cast in almost everything. And she's a very beautiful woman, but she is talentless.
At the least in the stuff that we've seen her in.
Yeah, I mean, I would need to see her with a different director or something, because
I think she was in Maniacs, or it was that Emma Stone and
she was very
she
stoic
was
in that
yeah, and it
too.
was a side character too. Like the character was not supposed to show too much emotion,
I
but
just,
this was
yeah,
just
her acting style just, and she has a small role in Civil War, and her line delivery is just as stilted here as it is in anything else. But we do have good actors in this movie. We have Kirsten Dunst, we have Nick Offerman, we have Stephen McKinley, we have Jesse Plemons, Kaylee Spaney. I'm not as familiar with Wagner Mora. I know I've seen him, but I don't know if I've ever seen him in anything.
I think he was in Narcos, and I've only
Which I never
seen
seen
part of
Narcos, yeah.
that. He was in Mr. and Miss Smith
I haven't
recently,
seen that, yeah.
and I saw that.
So he's, of all the actors in this movie who have prominent roles, he's the one where I didn't really know much. And I wouldn't say I walked away very impressed, but the thing is, if I didn't know much about Kirsten Dunst or Jesse Plemons or any of these people, I wouldn't walk away very impressed by them either. Because there's such emotional distance. It's a film with beautifully executed sequences. The shootout between the soldiers and the civilians, where the reporters are embedded with the civilians. I thought that was a wonderfully shot sequence. The Jesse Plemons sequence is paced. It is unnerving. I felt it in my gut.
I think what it is are just some really cool scenes that are connected very fucking poorly at the end of the day.
It's like an anthology film, but we're following the same characters and we don't really get to know them that well.
Yeah, it this feels as if like if you were to embed some of these scenes into The Last of Us, it'd be like, okay, yeah, we're in that fucking world, right? Especially if you're not going to detail much of anything in the background, expecting me to just take it in as is when America already feels as scary and on the verge of this.
Well, like you were talking about that, and I want the audience to understand this. If you haven't seen this movie and you're still listening, Garland does not give an ounce of context to how things have gotten to this point
No.
at all. Like, why are Texas and California in a thing called the Western Alliance? Never explained. I myself could come up with reasons. I know there are people who've said, oh, that's absurd. I think people discount how conservative California actually is because there's a lot of billionaires that live in California. But I also think people underestimate, in terms of the American political spectrum, how purple Texas is. So it could go either way, right? Like, I could see it being where, yo, it's predominantly liberal or it's predominantly conservative. That didn't get in my way. It's just the fact that the movie makes no effort to even through a single line of dialogue provide us with anything. We don't know how the president and what remains of the United States has become so weak. Like, there's no
Yeah.
explanation for that. I don't even understand, like, the reporters are supposedly embedded with who? Because we see them embedded with the Western Alliance at some point, but then there's that shootout between the soldiers and the civilians. I don't know who the soldiers are they're having the
No,
shootout with.
like we don't even get the point, like we see it from a distance, but we never have a point where like they're really going through a border, like true border where they're like,
There's the one scene where there are barricades up,
yeah.
but there's only one.
And it's just like, it's so. This movie, like, really was just disappointing. And it's gotten to the point that now I don't really want to watch anything Alex Garland does in the future. Men was fucking stupid. It was irritating at so many points. It was supposed to be, I'm gonna pretend that I understand what women go through, only to just.
But once again, it didn't have a. He says that, but then he doesn't really have any sort of point of view or anything to say about it.
No,
And same
it's.
thing with Ex Machina. Technology is dangerous. Okay, a
Yeah.
million other movies have said
Ex
that.
Machina got he got fucking lucky. I feel like he fucking got lucky between the fact that the visuals were very good and that the fact that the actor slipped in some emotions
When you
during
have
it.
Oscar Isaac, you have Domhnall Gleeson, you have Alicia Vikander. So you have three very strong actors
Yeah,
leading
three
your
strong
movie.
actors that like slipped in some charm in the whole thing. And then Annihilation, which I fucking hated. I understand there are people who love that film, but having loved the books and the fact that they whitewashed the cast really goddamn fucking pissed me off. It's the only film that I could understand that Alex Garman should have been, Garland should have been able to do as well as he
Because
could
it felt
have.
like it was in his wheelhouse.
Because like the characters are the main character is supposed to be emotionally like detached from everyone else.
And he
But
manages not to do
he
that.
like
Yeah.
erases the fact that she's Asian fucking American and now she's like played by Natalie Portman. This film just irritated me so fucking much. It was just.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about, because there's a lot of questions I had, and it's a movie where you don't need to answer them all, but there do need to be a hint of what, especially if we're in a civil war, right? So one of my things I wonder, well, how did the other factions break off beyond just the Western alliances? Because apparently there's like Florida has absorbed some states. There's other parts of the country, if you look at like the map they put out for the movie. There's no explanation to that. I didn't understand how the rest of the world was responding to any of this at all. It's as though there are no other countries on the planet. What happened to the nuclear arsenal that the United States has? Like, whose control is that in? I can make some assumptions, but you would think if we're not just following the everyman people, we're following journalists. So if you're following journalists, I would assume that journalists are keyed in more to those details and amongst each other might have conversations about those things, as opposed to you or me who's just trying to survive. All we're caring about is, when is this boat leaving here? When is this plane leaving here? How can I get out through this way? For the journalists who are trying to go to the heart of this and they're following the conflict to its grand finale, they never have a single discussion about the specifics of the war. What we get instead is Kirsten Dunst's character and Stephen McKinley's character having these long monologues about I always I never was like the thing that really annoyed me was the speech where she talks about the reason I went to all these other countries and recorded their wars and what was going on was to warn us not to do this. And that really pissed me off because I think anyone that watches this movie and feels a feeling of, disconcerted uneasiness, but they don't feel that when they see a film that's has the same kind of events, but it's taking place in Africa or in Central or South America. Well, why is that? Why does seeing this in the United States make you feel uneasy, but seeing it in a country you've never been to, that's entertainment, right? To me, the movie, like the reason if I was a journalist, I would not be going to, the Balkans or going to the Gaza Strip to warn Americans not to do that. I would be going there to bear witness to other people's suffering, genocides, ethnic cleansings, so that their stories could be heard by the rest of the
Their
world.
stories could be heard, and it's also this understanding that the US has allowed it to
Yes.
happen.
And the thing is, if any country deserves those things happening to it, I mean, I have family members I love that are in the United States, but if any country deserves it, it's going to be the root cause of it, which is the United States of America. So if I was a journalist, I'd go, yeah, I'm not surprised this happened here. What the fuck did we think was going to happen by making war one of our number one industries around the planet?
And the thing is about him being as apolitical as his was, and this is a fucking apolitical film, and that's the reason why it's fucking irritating.
The
You
president never even has a name.
think that between like Joel and Lee, the two characters, and along with like Sammy, there would be discussions about certain things that had happened to allow this to occur, what's happening in the Civil War right now. Like bits about history, talking about this legislation, talking about there's
There's
nothing.
like, yeah, no
There's
historical
nothing.
context.
All what it is that Joel is a fucking like adrenaline junkie, and it makes it far fucking worse because it's not, it hurts already that the journalists that the US have aren't really journalists. They are entertainers that are anchors,
Well,
right?
and then when you get to the people who actually do the writing, they're essentially writing press releases for capitalism. That's what it is.
And you think about like how when you have people traveling on a constant basis, being there even if they're not on the front lines, but if they're listening to the history, suddenly they start to become radicalized because of the situation. And the reason I think about this is like Anthony Bourdain. When he started traveling and talking to people, it was the most radicalized he became because he was talking to people who actually lived there on a regular basis. But instead, the most impactful moment is, oh, we're in a town where nothing's gone. Oh no, guys, there's shoot like there happens to be shooters on the roof. That's why they get to live a normal life. They're pretending that nothing's wrong. It was sickening. It was them being like, do you know there's a civil war going on?
Well, I mean, I don't even that would. I don't know if I go to that direction. I would say it could have remained apolitical, yet still giving some sense of how any of this happened. But what it reveals is the mindset of the people who made this are that they see contemporary politics as binary rather than multipolar, because they're worrying about upsetting liberals or conservatives, not understanding that political ideology on this planet is far more complex than these two right-wing ideologies. That the closest they come is they mentioned the Portland Maoists at one point. And I was more interested to know what's going on with them. How are they
Or like,
doing?
oh, the Antifa massacre.
Yeah, they mentioned little things in brief. So like Antifa Massacre could be, well, was Antifa massacred or did Antifa massacre someone? I think I know what was being implied, and we'll talk in a minute about some of the people that are credited by Alex Garland in this film. And that kind of reveals to me the real purpose underneath it all. He claims that this was the movie was supposed to be about journalism in war zones, but I couldn't make heads or tail of what the fuck he was trying to say about journalism in war zones because he doesn't. It's just, oh, journalism in war zones is dangerous. Well, yeah, there are wars going on, so I would assume if you're a reporter who's embedded and covering it, it's a dangerous thing to do. Was there something else you wanted to add to that thing I already knew, Alex? I think his work. I finally have gotten to the point where I think that his work proves to me he's incapable of saying anything about any of the interesting ideas he has we get a scene or two that's memorable, but everything about his work is hollow, that he's a conceptualist and he is not a storyteller. He has a concept of, hey, what if there was a movie about journalists traveling through America during a civil war? That's a great idea. And then he fails to develop it in any interesting way. I think if I was, you gave me the money and were like, make us a movie called Civil War about a civil war in the United States, I would make an anthology film. Three or four short films that take place in very different parts of the country about very different kinds of people. And you just show from their perspective what such a thing would look like. And you could have some events that are happening on the news that kind of tie things together. Because I think this film, it takes place from New York City to Washington, D.C. It doesn't even cover the United States. And so, like, it feels so narrow in its scope, both in the exposition and world building and what we actually see of what's going on, that I was not impressed at the end. Lee Smith, Kirsten Dunst's character, I think is supposed to be the main character of the movie, or at least kind of shares the spotlight with Kaylee Spaney's amateur photographer. That they're kind of like, we're seeing Lee is the end product, and then Spaney's character is where she started, right? Are you able to describe Lee Smith's character arc in this movie?
There is no character arc.
Well, there's only one scene I would say constitutes a character arc. One of their colleagues dies, and she looks at a photo of them on her camera and then deletes the photo. And that is the extent of her character
Yeah,
arc in this movie.
after telling the younger like photographers, like she when they're like, "Oh, would you take a picture of me if I died?" And she's like, "What do you think?" And that's all it is.
And so that felt like a waste because if the movie is about these characters, then these characters should have significant arcs. You could say that Kaylee Spaney's character is the main character. Does she have an arc? I mean, once again, everything is technical. She goes from being an amateur photojournalist to taking a very important photo. But in terms of character, in terms of her as a person, I guess she becomes more risk-taking as a photojournalist. I mean, that's it. She's more willing to run out while shots are being fired. That's it. But I don't know who she is, though. I said by the end of the movie, I still don't know
I
who
don't
she
know.
is.
And it's also like Joel at some point is talking to Sammy in the car as if he's prepping for the interview with the president, only for the end. It was nothing. It meant nothing because it was like, if we see the president, we have to kill him on shot.
Here's a question. We'll talk about that. So if a military, a revolutionary military has breached DC and breached these like massive barricade walls you've put up around the White House, you're gonna have the president hide under his desk in the Oval Office? There are safe rooms in, there's like a bunker under the White House. Like, why the fuck would you like? There's a thing where, okay, so we're not even going to deal with the political aspects. So we'll just make it a very realistic portrayal. It's not even that, because there's no way you would have the president locked up behind these massively thick doors in a bunker
I feel like the
under the White
president would
House.
have gone to fucking Canada or somewhere else, like
Yeah.
in
And
refuge.
he'd be pretending that he was in the White House, right? They'd have a fake Oval Office to broadcast from.
It felt to me, to some angles, when I think about the whole film, it felt as if it was a 2 hour long, even though it's not that long, ending of a series I didn't fucking watch.
Yeah.
So that I was supposed to be hanging on the edge of my seat about, only I had no idea why anybody fucking worked together to begin with. It's not as if when Kaylee Spaney's character comes in and she's like, "Oh, like Lee, you're my idol, blah blah blah." She starts talking about how amazing she is. And at no point is she like, "Oh, Joel, I loved your interview," and blah blah. None of that. We don't even get the sense of like Joel's like capacity as a person who interviews or
Yeah, they
writes.
keep saying he's a journalist. I never see him do any journalism.
Instead, he's kind of like always drinking hits on her, which in the film she looks like she's like 16.
But, like, he never does journalism.
So we don't get a set, we never see him like on his laptop, really like being like, okay, no, I got, or like
Well, I never really see
recording.
him interview anybody.
No, it's just him going like, what a fucking rush, guys, right? Like, because he wants to go in the middle of the night when they're shooting, and Lee's like, we're not doing that.
I would say you can look at similar films about the chaos of war. So you have a movie like Apocalypse Now, or I know you haven't seen it, but the Russian or the Soviet film Come and See. And these are both films that have a vision behind them. They have a purpose for being made. Apocalypse Now, for example, the whole purpose of it is to show the American military was never going to win a war in a country they didn't really care about against a force that was passionately devoted to resistance against them.
Yeah.
And that's a perspective. And the film allows that perspective to play out and allows that perspective and that thesis to affect the arcs of the characters. You think of Lawrence Fishburne's arc. You think of the chef's cookies arc in that movie. They're characters that aren't major characters, but they have arcs. Martin Sheen's character and the massive arc he undergoes in that
Like,
movie.
I think of like Michael Haneke, like the guy that did White Ribbon.
Michael Haneke. Yeah.
He had that film that was like said like something fucked up, and then like the war.
Oh, it's about wolves.
I would have rather like he took a page out of his book.
Well, and that movie is not about journalists. It's just about regular people.
It could like. I mean, I have better ideas how to scale down this fucking movie to make it more personal. Of it just being like she came back from the war, like, and suddenly her like the Kristen character's character, and then suddenly it turns out like America's in war. She has a daughter. She has like and she has two friends, and they're using the fact that they're pressed to try to get to somewhere safe, blah 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 or whatever. It felt like nobody had a connection except two characters. Like, yeah, my dad's on a farm pretending nothing's going on. No, not like when it gets to this fucking scale. Are you fucking kidding me? And like Alex Garland isn't fucking American to begin with. You think like if you're not American, I would have been like, oh man, rip them to fucking pieces. He does this?
We can also another film comparison, Children of Men. Another movie that is able to show the chaos of a society undergoing complete collapse and have incredibly emotionally powerful character arcs, but also great cinematography, great technical war sequences in it. And so Garland has no excuse here, in my opinion. I think that Civil War feels far too worried about stepping on toes to ever say anything about war.
It angers me because, to some degree, when we talk about, for example, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, feeling as if like there's nothing for them in this world. And I feel like in film, it should be reflected of us saying, man, we fucked up in this aspect and it wasn't good. When I think about Apocalypse Now, or I
Yeah,
think about documentaries that talk about
there's always a
Vietnam War.
regret.
Yeah.
There's no regret in
I
this
forget
movie.
there's like this really good documentary that made you cry that was about the
Oh,
Vietnam War.
that was Hearts and Minds.
Yes.
Very good documentary.
I was thinking about like having films that go, we fucked up. We should have done better.
And you know who
This,
shot that footage? Photojournalists and video
and you know,
journalists.
this feels like a fucking disservice to them. This is like saying, I don't want to step on toes. So you're fucking telling me that a teenager that watches this film later in the future, they're going to get nothing out of it. They're going to get nothing out of it except like, I really didn't want to anger anybody. Make someone angry so change can happen.
Well, because that's the problem in American society right now with media. If you make anyone feel anything, then they might not keep giving you money. Civil War is an exploitation movie made by a political coward who doesn't want to have to say why he thinks such an event might happen. I think by valorizing journalists, he takes the cliche liberal stance of pretending that journalists' hands aren't dirty from politics, which ignores the fact that most Western journalists, especially look at the Gaza situation, are either being editorially censored or just self-censoring because they like the flow of money into their pockets. And so they're giving these very biased, softening takes of a genocide. So journalists are not these sort of neutral factions in the midst of war. It made me think of the great Michelangelo Antonioni's films, particularly The Passenger, and a story he told that led him to make that movie. where he was commissioned by an Italian television station to go do a documentary in China about how it had developed since the Cultural Revolution had happened. And when he was in China, Antonioni said, you know, his goal was to be neutral and just film what happened. And he started having conversations with some of the Chinese people that were, you know, his handlers, and they challenged him on that with the idea. They said, you can't be neutral. No one can be neutral. They said, even with a camera, you're choosing where to point it, where not to point it. Your opinions are evident in the work that you produce. That's just an impossibility. And it's silly to say that you can remain neutral in any situation. And I think that's very true. I think people who pride themselves on their centrism and their neutrality, if we dig deeper, like someone like Alex Garland, what we will inevitably find is that they are very privileged people who don't want to have to confront the fact that the comforts they enjoy have been derived from the most brutal, violent colonialism and imperialism that has ever happened. And so by positioning themselves and journalism and media as some sort of like fourth estate that's separate from this mess, it gives them the leeway to never have to wrestle with those feelings. And that's essentially what civil war is. I would recommend Michael Parenti's Inventing Reality, which was written, the revised edition, I think came out in 91 or 92, still very relevant, where he dissects the way American media creates a very skewed vision of the country and the world for its citizens. And it's still applicable today. Two things that really set off some red flags for me, because I didn't have a problem with a movie called Civil War set in a semi-contemporary civil war in the United States. Because for me, once again, it came down to perspective, point of view. Like, what are you going to say with it? I think it's very silly and very reductivist and childish for anyone to go, well, you can't make a movie about that topic. No, you can. You can make art about fucking anything. The issue for me is, what are you saying? So I think of directors like Ruben Östlund, who I am diametrically opposed to him on almost everything politically, but I still think Triangle of Sadness was a great movie because at least there was a point of view and I understood what he thought and I was able to contrast my thoughts with him, and it was a very well-made, well-acted movie. Garland simply can't do that. He credits two people in Civil War that should be big alarms. First, he credits some of the file footage he uses at the beginning to Andy Ngo, NGO. And if you're not familiar with Andy Ngo, he is a fascist ideologue who fashions himself some sort of journalist from the Pacific Northwest, I think Portland specifically. He famously had his ass kicked by Antifa after antagonizing them. And a frequent guest on Joe Rogan. I think he's been interviewed by one of those moron Weinstein brothers. He makes the sort of intellectual dark web circuit, you know, the Shapiro, who's that, Jordan Peterson, the Canadian Kermit the Frog asshole. He's one of those people. So even if I used the guy's footage, I wouldn't credit him for it. He'd have to sue me to get that. He also gives a special thanks, Garland does, to Helen Lewis, who is a British journalist. She's on a show called Difficult Women, which I think is something like The View in the UK, but is very outspoken in her anti-trans opinions. She does this thing where she tries to say, no, I think trans people are great, da, da, da. But I don't think that trans women should be allowed in women's shelters because that makes cis women vulnerable to rape, which implies to me that she doesn't believe that trans women are women. She just believes that they're men and wearing women's clothing. That's what she means. So the fact that Garland gave her a special thanks tells me that I don't really need to respect much of what Garland has to say, even though he's incapable of saying anything. And so ultimately what Civil War is it's no different than the destruction porn of a movie like Independence Day.
Yeah.
The characters have just as much depth given to them in that movie as they do here. And it becomes about the spectacle, the mindless spectacle of it. If this movie makes you feel uneasy, but you've never felt that way about any other war film depicted in another country, then I think you're just a reactionary nationalist at the end of the day. Because there should be things that make you uneasy. The Jesse Plemons sequence is unnerving, but it also works as a short film. I didn't need to sit through an hour and a half of this to see that. You could just show me that in its entirety, that scene, and I'd be like, oh, wow, what a chilling film about like the Civil War and the way it could go down in America.
The music picks were horrible now that I
Well,
think
it was all over the place. Sometimes they felt like they were trying to do an homage to like Apocalypse Now with like 60s music. Sometimes like they would put a like and they the, I think the biggest problem with the music was it was ill-timed and tonally like clashed.
Yeah.
So you'd have a scene of like such intensity and then just this silly song would start playing and it didn't feel like there was any juxtaposition there that helped and enhanced the scene in any way. It just felt jarring and like, am I not supposed to be taking this seriously? So yeah, it's a big swing and a miss. But the thing we need to realize is that this is A24's highest grossing film they have ever released. So, A24 is also making a push to become increase its annual output of films, which I think we can definitely see this year. And also, I think to appeal to a larger audience, which will be the death of A24. I think A24 has always kind of been a rather one-dimensional millennial hipstery kind of label that would occasionally have a movie that stood out and was really great. But even movies that people love, like there's a lot of people that love Everything Everywhere All at Once. I felt that the spectacle of that movie detracted from the humanity of that movie. And I think the same thing here. The spectacle of Civil War, while impressive, detracts from the humanity I should be feeling about these characters in this movie. So A24 is simply becoming hipster Disney.
Yeah.
And I mean, as long as Ari Aster puts out movies, I'll be there to watch them. And if he's doing them through A24, I'll be there. And I'm not going to discount A24 as a whole as a studio, but I do think I'm going to become far more critical of future output as I watch it, because it needs to be more heavily criticized. If you want to put out a movie like this, and you should, I think it's a great idea for a movie, you have to have a point of view, and you can't hide your neoliberal nationalist reactionary tendencies under this false objectivism that Garland is doing. I think that's disgusting. And it's a film, like I saw somebody say, they said this doesn't feel so much like a thoughtful think piece on a potential civil war in the United States. It feels like Player Unknown's Battlegrounds, the Civil War, especially that scene with the civilians versus the soldiers, because
Yeah.
I think those civilians are a little too competent against trained soldiers than I would expect civilians to be. I felt like they should have been getting their brains blown out a lot more frequently. But I think if you go back, remember what those guys are wearing. Do you remember?
What?
Under their flak jackets?
Hawaiian shirts?
Yeah, you know what that is.
What is that?
That's Boogaloo Boys.
Great.
And they're the side that these journalists are embedded with, and that Joel is laughing it up and having a great time with after that battle's over. They're right-wing fascist Nazis. And so this is a film that has a scene that glorifies Boogaloo Boys in it. So I think Garland, while pretending to be neutral, sort of showed his hand in this movie.
Fuck a neutral ass bitch.
Well, that was this week's episode of the Pop Cult Podcast. We hope you enjoyed our episode. Make sure to check out our show notes for this episode, as well as our website, popcult.blog, where you can find lots more reviews. Make sure that you subscribe wherever it is you listen to podcasts so that you'll be notified when new episodes of our show are up. If you visit popcult.blog right now, you're going to find we're in the middle of a series on neo-noir, and this week we have Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, and David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, with reviews coming. We would ask that you do consider supporting us on Patreon. We've got a variety of different reward levels. And I want to thank our current patrons, Becca and Matt, for their donations at the Writer's Room level. That lets them pick one movie every month for us to watch and review. If you do that, you can also include your own thoughts in those reviews. No matter what level you donate at, you will get access to our patron-exclusive podcast. We've got a few complete series of those up. We're currently doing one right now, and we have more plans for those in the future. On next week's episode, we're going to be doing a double feature where we are featuring Black protagonists in two new movies. The first will be an indie movie with Ayo Edebiri called The Sweet East. And the second will be a poorly reviewed and pretty much maligned by critics and audiences alike review of The American Society of Magical Negroes. Well, until next time, you keep listening, we'll keep watching.